And welcome to this special episode of Mission Makers, brought to you from Davos, Switzerland, where I was lucky enough to be moderating a week of panels in the mountains at the Land Space Summit, which took place during the World Economic Forum earlier this year. It was a huge project, and I spent close to a year curating the programme for the summit, which was a gathering to collaborate on the most pressing issues of our current and future generations, converging the frontiers of technology and humanity to showcase the cultural essence of life in an immersive, elevated experience. We had some incredible speakers at our summit, from Deepak Chopra to the first African woman to pilot a spacecraft, Dr. Siam Proctor, and many other visionaries and thought leaders. I'll be sharing a few highlights from our panel discussions over the next few weeks, so stay tuned and let's dive straight into today's episode. Cultural leadership in times of crisis.
Today's theme is all about creativity and the spiritual codes of success, and I'm lucky to be joined by three incredible leaders who are really operating in that space and spearheading change. And today's discussion is really about cultural leadership in times of crisis. Obviously, we've all been through the last 2 years and the way that leadership has been catapulted to the forefront in terms of how it's bound together the teams, the families, all the different people that we surround ourselves with. So if leadership is weak, then of course everything is going to disintegrate around it. So very important for us to have this discussion around cultural leadership. What does it mean? How does it influence yourselves, but also the teams around you? How do you empower other people? And so to my right, I have Alessa Berg from Top Tier Impact, Samira Khan from Microsoft, and Dr. Royston Flood from CSPOC. So it'd be amazing if you could all introduce yourselves and tell us what you're doing, starting with Alessa.
All right, I'll go ahead. So my name is Alessa Berg. I run a company called Top Tier Impact. And today and overall at Davos, we have many TTI members, TTI ambassadors here in the audience as well. So Top Tier Impact is a global ecosystem focused on impact investing and sustainability. Our mission is really to accelerate the adoption of impact as a paradigm of investing, running companies, and frankly, just showing up as people, right? Showing up with certain values at the core of how we transact and how we create value. So we have a global network, we have an investment-focused unit, and a consulting business as well in the climate space. We'll get to more later.
So Samira Khan, I was most recently a part of the AI and Sustainability Market Development Team with Microsoft US. Soon to be switching roles. Prior to that was at Salesforce working on social impact, both internally as well as on the product side and externally as well.
Okay, are we on? Oh, Jesus. Yes, I'm the president of CSPOC, which is a United Nations accredited NGO out of Geneva. We focus on developing self-sustaining solutions. And we find that by linking health, education and enterprise together, while celebrating diversity and inclusion, we can achieve things that other change programs don't. We had a conference on Monday at the United Nations in Geneva, which was focused on women inspiring a peaceful and sustainable future. And there were more than 200 women in a community of women mostly, but a few men. And we had a delegation from the Ukraine as well. So I believe that it's actually women who actually are critical in these times of change. And it's also a time when we can all learn. So I said, well, I'm here to listen. And that's probably the same today.
Well, you're surrounded by two amazing women, divine feminine energy. And, you know, it's important for us, I think, to strip it back to the beginning. Let's go back to the core, the foundation. What does leadership mean to each one of you? And how does your culture influence your personal leadership style? So Royston, let's go the other way around.
Well, I was born in London in Guy's Hospital, and then I've lived all over the world. So I'm not just a one culture person. I believe in celebrating all cultures. I believe you have an opportunity to understand how people have got to where they are. And every culture has a sort of like a zeitgeist. I think for me, the discovery is that it's cooperation that is key. It's actually celebrating people. I believe also in Jack Ma's philosophy is try and get people that are more intelligent than you. I'm a dyslexic polymath, so I have one or two ups and downs in life. in Switzerland, I usually have a few challenges with the administration forms, but we're trying to develop a sense of humor between us. So leadership for me is about inspiring people rather than telling them. It's about emotional and spiritual intelligence rather than mental, physical. And it's about allowing people to be their best. It's about celebrating competence rather than trying to recognize incompetence. And I find that humor is an incredibly important lubricant of life. We have, at least I get many humorous situations, as you can imagine. But if you can have humor, it diffuses negativity. It creates an opportunity for people to be together and work together.
No, I completely agree. I also come from a background in motorsports, as many of you may know. And when we look at a team like Mercedes, one of the reasons they've been so successful is the no-blame culture. Because once you start pointing those fingers and alienating people and making them feel inferior, you can't really support and nurture that innovation and that unity and that bond in the team. Of course, everybody has to be accountable, but doing it like that is perhaps not the right
joy thing. And fun.
Exactly, join the fun. Samira, how about yourself? Tell us what leadership means to you and how your culture influences your personal leadership style.
Yeah, with time, I'm realizing that leadership to me is very much about decision making from the soul. And people generally think of that in a very fluffy way, but I think it's both intellectual as well as spiritual. And intellectually, I think you're drawing from your own culture, you're drawing from wisdom that's been passed through the generations, that's ingrained in you since you were a child. You're drawing from all the sensory influences around you. So it is very much also intellectual as much as it is based on your intuition. As far as, you know, my culture, my first question I had to ask myself is, what is my culture? So, you know, I am American in the sense that I was born there. So I think having grown up in America with the history of the country, there's a very pioneering side of me. You know, our education system tries to encourage creativity, individualism, entrepreneurialism. Yet at the same time, I have parents who were from South Asia, so Indian and Pakistani. And when they moved to this country, whatever their culture may have been back then, it was really about fitting in and kind of this notion you should stay quiet until you know what you're doing and you can be accepted. So there was that aspect of my culture as well. And I think how it's come together is in this quiet, pioneering spirit. So I hope to make change and innovate, but I do so in a quiet manner where I observe more first, try to figure out how I need to morph while retaining my values to influence those around me. And it's just how I'm comfortable operating. I will say a final aspect of the culture is just being global. So I've lived in the US, I've lived in Southeast Asia, UAE, etc. And I really like to understand and break down cultures and kind of leverage the most sort of beautiful and unique things I find in those cultures to advance shared goals that we may have. So those are some of the ways that my culture has influenced me. I'll leave on the sort of last note that there is an intersectionality between gender and culture. Just being a woman in these different cultures has meant different things, but I'll pass the mic for now.
We'll have to touch up more on that later.
Beautiful. Thank you, Samira. So I will start with the part about the culture and how that influences not just leadership style, but also how we live, how we operate. So from my side, I'm Swiss-Brazilian, and I grew up in the Italian part of Switzerland, this beautiful country you're in today. And so when you go to Italy, you're Swiss. And when you go to the other parts of Switzerland, you're Italian, right? And so holding this dichotomy, both in terms of like where I was, but then also my identity in terms of like different cultures, has been something that has followed me from the very, very beginning and has always, I guess, until I realized it, because I think for a long time it was a bit unaware and at times isolating, right? Of like understanding, but where do I belong? Where do I not belong? And I think that integrating it in how I live life and how I look at life, it becomes something about being a global citizen, but most importantly, it's something about having compassion and understanding for all different flavors of the human experience, for all different flavors of culture, right? And being able to relate to all of those. Because ultimately, you know, we are living life in this subjective way. And the more we can understand our subjective experience and what other people are having as subjective experience, the more we can actually relate to each other and understand each other and have a good time and create and build, right? So for me, it's really about this kind of insider-outsider perspective, having given me so much understanding of how others can completely differently relate to life, right? And I keep on bringing it into my leadership style in terms of like trying to truly understand and build bridges and, you know, remove conflicts and again, have compassion. And so getting to leadership, I really want to unpack leadership for a second because I think that our culture has, ironically, our culture, like the general global culture, has put leadership on a pedestal, right? Oh, leaders, leaders, leaders. And sometimes when I really reflect more deeply about this, I get confused because ultimately to me, leadership is about serving. And leadership is our responsibility. Leadership isn't something glamorous, like to, you know, like put on, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But I really believe that leadership, when fully owned and understood, is a responsibility and is a commitment of showing up in a certain way and showing up to serve everybody who works with you and who benefits or interacts with what you're creating in the world. And so I think that this relates also to, you know, when you trace back like leadership in like past centuries, like being a king, being a queen, ultimately is about serving the community, right? And building value for everybody. So the way that I relate to leadership ultimately is that taking that responsibility to show up in a way that can add value and, you know, add purpose to the people that I work with and then to the people that we impact positively around us.
Very well said, Alessa. I completely agree. And, you know, whether we lead teams, we also lead our own lives at home. And in some shape or form, we are leaders. You know, we are responsible for the health or the nurturing of our parents or our children, our grandparents. And as you said, it's a sort of servient mindset. And it doesn't just relate to just the business card and the title that you have. So in the times that we're living, of course, you know, we're here in the mountains, and it's been 2 years since, you know, we've been able to reconvene in this way, and a lot has changed naturally, not naturally, actually, unnaturally. I think we can all say that many feel like politics has failed us and is continuing to fail us. And so, Samira, what are your sort of thoughts on this for other cultural institutions to step in and take guidance on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think corporations have typically not been viewed as cultural institutions. However, given the clout, the power they have, the capital, the resources they have, there is an onus and a responsibility upon corporations to take more of a role in playing stewards of culture, because they have such a great influence on our market, on how things are funded, you know, the caregiving economy in the U.S. and how women perhaps are paid and compensated and given benefits. I mean, you name it. They have a lot of influence over policy, et cetera. And I don't view culture as disparate or separate from other disciplines. Rather, it's the foundation from which many disciplines emerge, or it should be at least the framework. So I think corporations as, you know, cultural stewards, filling in the gap that governments have left, almost serving as quasi-government entities, need to be held accountable by society in a particular way. And we need to try to help rewire what we value so that leaders feel the permission to lead with purpose, not just think of the bottom line, so that employees feel empowered to pursue their passion and contribute to society beyond sort of business value, et cetera. So I think it requires a sort of a reframing of value. And I think we're seeing some
sort of leaders emerge, but it's been very tough for businesses to align around any other agenda but the bottom line. So unless markets change, I don't see that changing. But I think even more important than that are actually movements. So movements are not limited to corporations, they're not limited to governments, they're not limited to startups. They're really about the individuals and people like you and me coming together in spaces like this and deciding that we have a shared goal and we're going to drive a movement and we're going to try to move startups, move companies, move government leaders in a certain direction and deciding to take action based on our deeply held values and beliefs. So I think movements is, you know, can be viewed as a cultural institution as well. And the underpinning is really like what changes hearts and minds. And for me in my life, the arts have always been a way that I've been influenced to change. So if I see it in film, if I see it in written word, if I experience it by travel, if it really moves me, then I move to act and think differently. And it transcends that experience into the way I do work, into the way I lead my personal life, into the movements I join. So I think the more individuals can have these experiences that awaken them through the arts or through whatever sort of gives them energy, I think the more we'll be able to create an alternative to relying on politics as sort of a decision maker or a holder of our futures.
And how do you think that the accountability you touched upon as we enter, and we're discussing this earlier in the room, we enter Web3 and, you know, decentralization, what is the role then of keeping those big companies that have sort of monopolized the space accountable as we go into that decentralization space?
Yeah, so I think right now we don't have the tools necessarily in place to, let's say, measure impact. We don't necessarily, I mean, we have some tools. We don't have an economy that's built around, right, alternative value. I think in the absence of that, it really is coming from employees organizing. There's activism is a part of it. It's not the only way. Investors who are activist investors who are taking a stake in particular causes. And also the more that we are creating this bridge between emerging markets and other markets to drive innovation across borders so that we're sharing narratives, we're sharing stories. So the impact is more visible through the media. It's more visible through voices. Corporations are forced in some way. Their hand is forced to act. So I think Roe versus Wade has been really interesting to me as an American because it is not something I ever would expect a company to weigh in on, just given being older and what I've seen of corporations. They tend to avoid touchy sort of sensitive issues that go across religious lines, that go across politics, because it's very risky. But now I think what companies are realizing is that if they take an impact-driven lens, the risk is higher in some cases of staying silent, especially if it's an impact that's going to affect their industry in a certain way.
Do either of you have anything more to add to what she said or any thoughts?
Yeah, so thinking about technology and zooming into Web3 or like thinking about how we can actually support these drive like towards, you know, not just reflecting cultures and different cultures into it, but innovating and creating more value than it was ever possible before. I think that, you know, technology is neutral. It's all about the intentions of the people who use the technology. And in my view, this goes for all technologies. They can enable utopia or dystopia. It's our choice, and it's about what we put into it and how we leverage it. And so we talk about Web3 a lot here at Davos. There are a lot of houses that are covering different companies in the Web3 space, or rather protocols. And in my view, I can see a world where the decentralization and the enablement of communities to be organized through this technology actually reflects infinite diversity, reflects more different cultures than ever before, right? Because it's not been possible until today with a technology like distributed protocols to be so easily enabled as citizens, as individuals, as communities, to self-organize, not just in a way of like, oh, you know, we're going to run our community, but frankly, to produce value, right? To create an economy around the interactions that you have, to vote, to, you know, have your own currency, right? And so we are in a place where this technology can enable us to have this extreme diversity all around the world, so a bottom-up approach to not just saying, oh, this is the perfect top-down culture and everybody like should reflect this. I don't believe in that. I think that diversity is beautiful, and as much as possible, we should integrate it, right, so that we can interact in a world that is more fun, more enjoyable, and creates more value than ever before. And so this technology can actually allow us to do that. For example, decentralized autonomous organizations, right? If we see DAOs taking over and actually like being as easy to set up as possible all around the world for common people, then that is going to reflect more diversity, right? And that is naturally going to come together into a society that can operate with more diversity. And so I could go on for other technologies, right, and talk about the good and the bad. So I think it's important that we reflect about both sides and then choose the lenses and the ways that we want to use technology.
Absolutely. It's the sort of challenge in a way of keeping that culture and that innovation and the traditions that come with that, but in the exciting space of capturing that innovatively. Royston, let's talk about the C-suite. And when I guess all companies now really have to bake in that culture of resiliency, just given what we've been through in the last 2 years. So what's your sort of guidance to those leaders, to really lead that ship and build that culture from the get-go of resiliency so that they can flow and with effortless ease through crisis?
I think the interesting thing is that we're now in a world which is unpredictable. We are seeing natural and complex disasters. We're seeing many things that we wouldn't have envisaged before, and therefore conventional rule-based management can't really work. We're also seeing the impetus from the pension funds, who actually own the companies, saying, well, what about social impact? How are you treating the people? I'm reminded of France Telecom that did a downsizing when people committed suicide. Under international law, the directors were put in jail. So we're now in an area of accountability where we have to try and engage the whole culture. We have to engage agility. And I believe that agility comes not from process and task. It comes from emotional and spiritual intelligence. And I think that's the Rome, what has always been the power of women in an organization. And I think we need to engage women in a different way. I think there needs to be, we all know about the glass ceiling, which I think is disappearing gradually. It depends upon the culture and where you are in the world. I think we then talk about the sticky floor, where women not believing that they can do it. But I think when you find women empowered in organizations, you get this agility, you get the ability to be more resilient. And I think if you get people solving the problems at the grassroots rather than pushing the problem upstairs, if you get people being prepared to work together with the notion of loving kindness, which I think is actually the weapon of mass destruction that we have of our age. So this notion of just being kind, I'm reminded of a manager in, I won't name the company, who was told that a female manager was told she was too soft and she should beat the people up more. Now, this is a culture that we have to completely let go of. We have to recognize that if you inspire people, you create this magic. It's creating the picture together. And yes, you do need a frame around the picture to provide some boundaries, but let's make beautiful pictures together and we hopefully will create a better planet. And as I say, the shareholders are now saying, this is what we want. So, I mean, if you take the pension funds, they have to find a home for $30 trillion a year.
You know. Talking about letting go, I'd love to hear from each of you about, you know, traditional cultural institutions like the education system that are, you know, 100 years old and haven't evolved with the times, suddenly found themselves obviously in this incredibly difficult situation. And almost outdated in a world that's changing so quickly, more and more people choosing not to go to university and, you know, pursue passions in a different way. So what are your beliefs on how that sort of cultural system can adapt, can grow, and can keep up with the new challenges and opportunities that we are in?
The biggest challenge of the education system is mindsets. we, in the primary education, we often destroy the curiosity of children just so they can put in a tick in the box in terms of exams. We have to find a different way of experimenting with life and lifelong learning. It certainly doesn't stop when you have you've got a degree or any sort of qualification. You need to keep on going. And I think there's a criterion of bringing the grandmothers and the back into that education role, and the grandmothers actually in business, so that if you have young women leaders who hit this sort of barrier for one reason or another, and I think working from home gives more flexibility now, but you need this grandmothering input of, you know, experienced business leaders who go back and help the people in the lower rungs. And I think that's the way we're going to find a better world. So education is lifelong learning. Education is always accepting that you don't know anything and believing that you can learn more. And it's the courage and the humility to do that. So try and break the mindsets, try and discover the beauty of life and learn in different ways.
Yeah. So I definitely agree with you on learning different ways. And I think what's really enabled that is, and this sort of creation, this innovation has been technology, because it's allowing individuals to organize and create new communities, which was mentioned earlier, to deploy assets differently, to learn about different sort of cultures and geographies more easily. And as a result of that, I think people are less reliant on traditional institutions. They can get their education and their skilling from different places, get certified and accredited. I still don't think it's as easy for some of these sort of self-made learners to get the same sort of recognition, but I think that will change over time. I will say that despite that, though, I do see a role for what's, quote, traditional cultural institutions to play, depending on, you know, the market you're in or the country you're in. I know in countries that are rife with economic disparity, corruption, etc., people are still turning to cultural institutions, such as religious institutions, as a place of hope, because it gives them something to believe in. And if they don't have access to a community or technology in the way some other countries do, if they don't have access to a system that reflects and supports them, they're going to rely on other places to support them. And I'm a spiritual person, so I think there's a place for cultural institutions such as religion still. I think it's not for everyone, but it still has a space in terms of keeping us connected to ethereal sort of concepts and history that we've built over time. So I don't see them entirely going away. I just see almost some forms of action being swapped out depending on, you know, where you believe, what you believe in, where you live, and what speaks to you.
To me, it goes back to diversity again. How is it that we live in the 21st century and our systems, our education systems, are all about people doing the exact same thing and coming out as cookie cutters, like with the same skills, with like the same standards, right? I really believe that every person comes to this world with unique skills, unique talents to contribute to the whole. And we haven't yet reflected into our education system how to best support that. Because the reality is that the education system right now works better for some people rather than others. Like, it doesn't mean that just because you excel or don't, like, you're better or worse, right? It's just that the system is going in a certain direction, right? And some people get left behind or left wondering, like, where do I fit into the picture? And so I believe that leveraging technologies, going back to leveraging technologies for good, leveraging technologies and being able to actually use them with personalization, with tutoring, with various ways in which we can enable every individual to be an individual and to develop their unique skills. I think that's the future, and I see a future in which in our world, everybody is actually aligned with their natural purpose and their passions. Like, how is it that we don't live in that world yet? I think ultimately to be able to leverage technology to put us in that place is gonna be the most efficient thing for our economy, right? Because this is about efficiency ultimately. Like, it's not just like doing good or just being fair. It's actually about efficiency as well. An economy where everybody can contribute to the best of their unique abilities to the whole is the most efficient one. And so I hope, and you know, I'm definitely behind supporting from an impact investment perspective in the education side of things, a world in which everybody can show up to the best of their potential, no matter what their potential and talents are.
Definitely, I completely agree. And you know, at the moment, that education system is fear-based, and that then goes all the way on until you get to, you know, university, then you get a job, and then it's a very competitive, cutthroat, dog-eat-dog world, as they say, right? And that's what creates this insecurity, this aggression, this fear. Instead, like what you were saying, of when you're so young and you're coming into this world bright-eyed, taking it all in, and you're curious, and some people lose that spark because age 3, age 5, if you don't pass the entrance exam, you're not going to that school, and you know, the rest of your life is going to be determined by that action point. So I think it's really important that we can somehow revolutionize that system. And I think we're hopefully at that intersection of doing some of that. Samira, you touched upon, the sort of South Asian culture and different parts of the world. I mean, how do you think they will fare with this changing landscape where it is much harder to change that mindset? And get away from that very conservative sort of mindset.
Yeah, I think technology does have a role to play because it gives you exposure to, you know, narratives from other cultures, different ways of thinking, access to education unlike ever before. I do think the movement toward sort of interdisciplinary individuals and being able to market their skills to other countries sitting in their home country is a piece of it. Like, for example, I have been mentoring, you know, young women in Pakistan, and I have been completely blown away by their drive to code and become proficient in STEM and to participate in international forums with the idea that they will get a job in tech. And that's pretty amazing that technology has served as an industrial sort of an industry or a platform for them to really think differently, to make decisions differently, and to get their families behind it, because it represents respect, it represents sort of creativity in a unique way. So I think the more we can allow that type of access to those countries, the more we'll see, you know, female leaders coming out of the countries who will then serve as change makers and who will really kind of bring others along. So I would say it's a combination of technology and just change making and supporting and finding those individuals. I think if you can somehow find these passionate individuals who are driving change at a micro community level and support them with the first check, support them with social capital, I think that would do wonders, and I think there are people who are thinking about this.
What about the historical sort of tech, the people that get left behind because they don't have access to that tech as that world is moving into that space? What are your thoughts on making that, you know, as accessible as possible and the challenges that will result culturally as a result? Perhaps all of you could answer then.
I think, again, that's where impact investing can come in from the perspective of how do we make this infrastructure cost efficient, accessible, and how do we, when you zoom back out, ultimately think about policy and think about the global picture of how countries are supported or enabled, you know, especially if we're thinking about development finance. So at Top Tier Impact, we interact with development finance institutions. They have an impact mandate in the way they invest. So they really are about measuring impact, and they deploy a lot. And especially in these markets that we're going into, they become a major source of funding. And so thinking a little bit from a zoomed out macro perspective of like, what does it take to have this infrastructure available? What does it take to have subsidies? Like, what does it take to design systems where this is accessible one way or the other? I can give you an example. So we've interacted through our investment unit with a company based in India that has built this incredible network that is private schools that are very affordable, because in the Indian education system, that is the prevalent say, source of education for a rising, like, poor to middle class, actually. And so there's a lot of diversity in that ecosystem at this point in terms of different schools. And so these guys, like, are financing at scale schools like that, making sure that the education for the educators is available and the technology is available as well. So I think it's a combination of enabling the private sector to get to that, but also thinking about from a public agenda, public policy perspective, how do we make sure that that equality is as present as possible?
Absolutely. Do you either have anything to add to that? Or do you think Alessa summed it up beautifully? Great. So if we'd love to open up the floor for any questions to our panelists.
Hello. I'm just interested to know, like, where the passion came from to, you know, initiate such a venture aligned. And I see where you're going. I just caught the tail end of that there, but I'm really interested to know where that, you know, birth and why the passion is there.
Is there a specific panelist you wish to address that to?
Sorry, the lady that was just speaking.
For me? Yes, that's a great question. Thank you for asking that. Where the passion came from, you see, Top Tier Impact was not even meant to be my next company. And I think that's probably why it ended up being so natural and so aligned, right? Like, it came from a place of observing what's going on in the world a few years ago. And actually, I realized that coming to Davos in early 2019 was a major source of inspiration, but not necessarily inspiration of like, oh, wow, all these world leaders talking about these amazing stuff, quite the other way around, basically, of just thinking, how is there so much talk? And it's so obvious that it's just talk. I don't even remember which specific panels, like, what it was, right? Because I was giving some speeches at side events, and I didn't even go to much of like the main programming, but I just remember leaving Davos and thinking, I have to do something. I just have to contribute. And I've always been a system thinker. I like to look at things from a horizontal perspective and think, how do we enable this whole machine to work? And so it was in between companies, you know, when I had some months of free time and I naturally gravitated to what I like, which again is like system design, like system thinking, and looking at where are we going on the critical path, like the critical path being like what's really required for humanity to advance. Where are we going on that critical path? Because that's exciting to me, right? To reflect about these big problems. And then where do I naturally fit in terms of like leveraging my talent, my passion? And so what happened is that the more I looked at impact as a whole system, right? So the impact investment, impact entrepreneurship space, the more I saw not just an amazing paradigm for our economy and our society that relies on better values, like from every perspective, both in terms of people's individual happiness, but again, also in terms of economic efficiency, right? Collective value maximization is always better than individual, right? Like prisoner dilemma, obfuscated dynamics. So for those who don't know game theory, like prisoner dilemmas run our economy. Like basically we have these situations where if company A doesn't do deforestation, company B is going to do it. So company A is kind of like, I might as well do it, right? And so all this thinking that I had going on, right, about the system and about impact and about how can we accelerate an impact-based paradigm eventually led me to gradually put together impact investors that I already knew. You know, I was doing a lot of angel investing at the time. And just looking at how can we accelerate the growth of such a positive paradigm? And I really thought I was doing that in between my activities in this gap of time I had. It was a gap year that never ended up being a gap year, because 1 year later, I realized that I had my next company because it was growing so much. And so I was too involved in it to just move on to set up the next company or, you know, be in the venture capital investment space. I was just in it. So I think that the passion, to get back to your question and sum it up, came from having this playtime, having this time of just spending it on what I'm interested in and spending it on where can I contribute the most, where I'm also excited to contribute, and then gradually form something that at some point became an activity, became a profession, became a company.
Wow. Nice.
Thank you.
Amazing answer. Thank you so much. But I wanted to add to that just quickly. What is it that you need to accelerate the growth now that you're in the position you are? You feel that you can grow further. What would it be if we were in an ideal world and you could ask of anything? What would that be?
We want this paradigm of impact investment and impact entrepreneurship to be far out and wide everywhere. And that's part of why we're here at Davos, right? Because the incumbents, the current structures, like, we are embracing them. Ultimately, this is not about, oh, forget about, like, you know, the old stuff, let's bring in the new. It doesn't quite work that way from our perspective. We're all in this together, whether we like it or not, right? And so it's about building bridges to understand each other, right? And sort of like gradually get there and meet people where they're at, right? And so I think that for some of the incumbents to understand, like, the fear as well, right, of, like, what's going on in the world, like, technology, geopolitical challenges, like, all of that, to be able to understand it and bring impact into that. For us, it's about how many of these bridges with corporates, investors, right, can we build to help bring this there?
Well, hopefully I can aid you on building those bridges, because it's beautiful what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions?
Yeah. Working? Oh, yeah. My question goes back to leadership, and also I wanted to ask Alessa, what are the criteria or values that you see as most important for leaders in the future? What are the core values?
I think we can all sum it up with compassion. And I think that the practice of compassion is so beautiful and never-ending, right? Because it starts with ourselves, right? I mean, I started my career in a very high achiever type of way because, you know, talking about the education system, I didn't know any better, right? It was, for whatever reason or mix of skills, like, easy to do well at school and then to get those jobs, right? And did that make me happy? Absolutely not, right? And I kind of knew it. Eventually, I was trying to move towards the entrepreneurship space, which I had entered as a child and then eventually very early in my career as well. But I think that ultimately compassion for ourselves and then for everybody else, like everybody who's mirroring to us things that we like or don't like about ourselves, is the fastest way to grow professionally, individually, in my view, and collectively as well. And so really, I would sum it up with compassion and actually sit with what that means, right? We all have different definitions of it. And I think it's like a never-ending well as well, right? You can approach it superficially. A few years ago, I didn't even know the meaning of the word, right? And today, I'm just so grateful for how more deeply and deeply I've been able to understand what it means to practice compassion, like, in our day-to-day life and with all the people and systems we interact with. And it's always, you know, it's a practice where sometimes, like, we get out of it, right? And then it's also about having compassion for ourselves, to be getting upset, getting angry, getting frustrated about things. That's okay, right? We're all humans. We're all trying our best. But quite frankly, I found it the best way to actually accelerate growth, both professionally and personally, in how we show up.
I mean, if I could add to that, I think compassion, patience, tolerance, humility, and sharing are the key prerequisites of leaders. And I think we all have a responsibility to listen to our children calling from the future and create a world now which is more appropriate for those times.
Do you have anything to add, Samira?
The only thing I'll add is that I love the compassion piece of it. And I think for me, step one has been just empathy, instilling that sort of skill, that vision, that leading from the heart. So being able to really engage with others, hear their story, having patience, time in the day, for purposeful conversations with those around me, unlikely people I may not speak to, and taking that extra effort and building sort of that well of empathy, I think that helps me show up with compassion. So that's the only thing I'll add.
One thing I'd like to add there, and I think compassion, gratitude, so important, and empowerment. At the end of the day, if you're not empowering those people around you, you're holding other people back. You're not paving the way for those other generations, your other teammates to, and we've probably, all of us, have some level of success in this room. Somebody helped us, And especially we're going to discuss this in a lot more detail on Thursday when we talk about soft skills for a digital world, because everything is becoming more automated. And in the end of the day, it's those human skills that are going to carry us forward and allow us to thrive in that changing world. I see a raised hand there, so you can take that question, please.
Yes, hello, my name is Marco. Thank you very much for all your speaking. It is very interesting. I would like to share with you one of my thoughts about leadership, because I think leadership is service. And I would like to know if you agree with this or not.
That's how we defined it that's at least how I defined it when answering that question in the beginning of the panel. Yeah, absolutely. And I was also sharing how, for some reason, this doesn't seem to be the common understanding of leadership, right? We glorify leadership a lot. And that's kind of counterintuitive, right? There is responsibility in leadership. It doesn't have to be heavy. Like, I like lightheartedness, right? In like how to show up, because we all want to enjoy ourselves as we do all of this, right? But there is a responsibility in it, and there is service in it. Absolutely agree.
I think I'll just add to that. Oh, sorry. I'll just add to that. I think it's about learning lessons, firstly, because any leader knows that they don't have all the answers. But if you can learn the lessons, and then it's making a difference, which is about, you know, having a clear idea of where you're going. And finally, I think it's, as you say, it's about service, and service above self sometimes as well.
Yeah, so I definitely agree that it's service. I think what leaders struggle with or could use some help with is in service of what and how to prioritize. And I think the onus is now upon us to help that and to drive that movement so that there is more clarity given where they sit, et cetera, where they can have this additive impact, or what their impact is actually on their employees, their communities, et cetera.
I think in a way it's actually a service to all the stakeholders, both in the organizations and in the communities. And that talks about a responsibility. It's not over there, it's not just making money, it's about trying to move the business forward. I mean, I come from a family businesses, and we've always been part of the family, part of the community, and listening to people and making sure everybody has a secure base, because that's the difference. If you have a secure base, by and large, you get the best out of people.
Very interesting, because actually we didn't touch upon the culture and family businesses, and actually that's one of the hardest things to change, especially as many businesses are handed down generationally. Maybe you could touch upon that for us for a couple of minutes.
Family businesses have got pluses and minuses. They tend to have a sort of a more of a moral responsibility, I think. But on the other hand, they can get stuck in mindsets. So we've always done it this way. And of course, for family businesses, in terms of leadership, it's how do you pass the baton to the next generation? And it's just as difficult for the next generation, because they've obviously been in the environment of, you know, parents or a family that's been successful. So there's huge self-worth issues about how do you deal with that. So in families, what most people do is they put their children to other family businesses so that they can cut their spurs or cut their achievements and then come back into the core family business. That's a much more gentle way of doing it.
It's a good way of doing it for sure. Maybe time for like a couple more questions and then we'll end for the day. Somebody could pass that lady there a mic, please.
This is such a wonderful talk. Thank you all for sharing beautiful, beautiful ideas and ways that you work in the world. I'm on the cultural production side. I'm a filmmaker and an artist, and so I'm very interested in how you utilize that kind of cultural production to further the goals of solving the problems of the world. And especially you, Samira, you spoke about culture and film and art. How do you see that engagement?
Yeah, I've only done writing myself, haven't been a film producer except for trying to make mini documentaries back in college, but it moves me like no other to really see things in visual form. So the visual arts are very, very important. It's such an important cultural institution. And I've seen large amounts of philanthropy in this space, but not an adequate market for supporting interdisciplinary artists, emerging artists, even those using technology. I don't see that type of private capital and the type of markets that we need to really continue to facilitate that in certain ways, but apparently that doesn't stop creatives. I mean, the world is getting more and more interesting and creative, and production quality is higher. So I think creating some sort of a market where these ventures are valued differently, are valued by traditional VC, et cetera, would be very interesting. And I think it's despite that, it's still a powerful lever of change to bring people closer from different communities and show them realities on the ground. So I know virtual reality is super important to me from the position of being able to allow certain people to experience what other people are experiencing in war, et cetera, to bring them closer to the topic. And I think the arts play a role in that sensory experience.
I'll just add a quick comment on that. So how to leverage, right, like storytelling and content, because actually right now in this room, we have two people that I just want to give a shout out to, Rob and Max on my team. We're producing a TV series on impact for Gaia, Gaia.com. So give it up for Rob and Max, who are filming right now. Yeah. So for us, this is all about bringing to a larger audience that doesn't necessarily get to be exposed to all the things that the people, you know, us in this room and people here at Davos get to be exposed to, right? We get to talk about a positive future. We get to see what impact ventures are doing, where investments are going. But at the end of the day, like, the world we live in is getting increasingly polarized, and a lot of people just get this negative media, right, about all the next disasters that seem to be lined up one after the other. And so for us at Top Tier Impact, is really about taking like these positive messages and concrete actions that we see, and then package them with storytelling in a way that can resonate with a broader audience. And not necessarily about, oh, wow, there's all these people doing these amazing things. More like connecting with them, right? The entrepreneurs we're interviewing and featuring in the series, like, we're asking them about their challenges, right? About their toughest moments. Like, we want to take the human out of the story or from the story, right? To show to people that this is happening, like, by individuals that are just like them, right? And so make everybody part of this movement as well.
I get slightly disappointed by some of the movies that are focused on violence and the worst aspects of humanity, because it's such a powerful vehicle. I think we should maybe consider how we can actually lift the quality of life. I go to Cannes occasionally, which is an interesting sort of circus. We're involved in a movie at the moment as an experiment called Love Is, about three generations of women. Women are the anchors in the family. But then we had to add in sci-fi and paranormal and make it a musical comedy so you can actually say things which probably wouldn't have been so easy. I think we need, as people, to challenge this plethora of pain and violence that often dehumanizes women, dehumanizes people. And, you know, it's only about going to films that make a difference, because it's all about box office. So if you go support films that actually make a difference in life, perhaps we'll have a change to the medium.
I'd just like to add to that, because creative storytelling, also think about gaming and the way that our children are interacting with games. If the number one game out there is Call of Duty, that's the mindset that children are being instilled upon, fear, violence, shooting. I personally am very against that game, just because I just see how infiltrated it is amongst so many children, and how desensitized they then become to violence, and how that breeds in schools, and how that the later on carries through to life. So I think, you know, all four of us here are all in some shape or form involved in media, creative storytelling, whether it's gaming, film, music, TV. And so, you know, I think it's really about keeping those values that you hold to your core, and really, you know, being authentic with it, and challenging, as you said, the and supporting the ones that really are doing it in the right sort of way. Maybe time for one more question, and then we'll wrap up.
Hi, I'm Ivana Fruda. Just a question and a comment, actually. I think it's all about shifting the mindset from the mindset of fear to the mindset of abundance. Mm. And if you can resonate with that, could you please share with us how could we ourselves cultivate the mindset of abundance? Thank you.
Just look around. We're in the mountains. We have nature all around us. Nature is abundance. As somebody was saying earlier on our panel, actually, with Ivona, that at the end, we can all kill each other as humans, but nature will always breed life. And that's the abundance. I don't know if you three have anything to add, but...
I like that, what you just said. I mean, ultimately, this goes back to right now, like the challenges that we're facing, they're not about, oh, we're destroying the earth. Like the earth is fine one way or the other. It's about our species not making it through because we're very delicate and we haven't been around for a long time on this planet. And so what we're screwing up is actually our living conditions, right? When dinosaurs were around just a few million years ago, this planet was absolutely unlivable for our species as it is today. So we have to remember that we are delicate and we are part of this ecosystem. We're in balance with it. It's been proven in the theory of evolution that we actually don't evolve as a single species, like Darwin originally stated. We evolve as entire ecosystems in balance with each other, right? And so being able to remember that, right, of the abundance that we have around us and in nature, right, as a species, I think is humbling and sort of like essential to how we do things.
Yeah, I mean, I had a thought when I was basically coming to Davos yesterday. So I've always recognized that, you know, if we don't have a planet, we don't have humanity or humankind, and there'll be nothing left if we don't maintain or foster that regenerative force. But as I was coming, I was having a little trouble with some of my luggage, and a stranger came up to me from Ukraine, a young boy, and he said, you know, let me help you. And we got to talking about the war, and we just connected at a certain level because I wasn't using my cell phone. I was cognizant that I was speaking to a stranger who had just helped me. And that circle of kindness is very much still alive amongst humanity if given the space to breathe. And right after that, I was stuck in the rain and some strangers just decided to give me a ride. And I thought, you know, how ironic. I'm on this train. I see this beautiful greenness. I'm experiencing human kindness in this way. And if only we could use that kindness, that connection better to really save this verdant greenness, you know, we wouldn't be in so much trouble. So that thought just crossed my mind as I was coming here.
I think fear is the most dangerous thing that we have in our society. And it's not just actual fear, it's perceived fear that keeps people in paralysis. If you look at self-worth, when you have low self-worth and you're driven by fear, you often move into displacement activities, and that's things like eating disorders, substance abuse, and so on. And even if you try and solve those, it doesn't work because people will go on to something else because they don't want to face learned helplessness. If you improve self-worth, and that's where leadership comes in, which is improving the self-worth of all the people you interact with and shining, then people naturally move away from these displacement activities and they learn hope and love and learned optimism.
I couldn't agree more. Perception forms reality. And one of my favorite quotes by Rumi is, you're not a drop in the ocean, but you're the entire ocean in a drop. And I think that's something that hopefully is very inspiring for a mindset of abundance. I saw the lady over there had a question, so we can take that as the last question and then enjoy the evening.
Thank you so much. I think just the last question is about, I guess, mental health and well-being, you know, when you're a leader, and especially like in times of crisis, going through, let's say, the COVID-19 pandemic, how do you manage that and what kind of empathy does that create for you as a leader, but also for your team and the whole environment? But this, yeah, the question is for all of the speakers to contribute.
Maybe I should have a go at that one. We see mental health as a ticking time bomb. COVID has already created this tidal wave that will be going through our system for some time. You find that if you have a physical wound, it often heals in about 10 weeks or so. But mental health challenges can heal, take months and months, even not years. we're incredibly worried about Ukraine, because once something has gone on for a generation, it can go on forever. A generation is about 20-odd years. So Northern Ireland, if you talk to Lord Alderdice, for example, he will say that the story that's told from parent to child and so on can be distorted. It's a Chinese walls thing. So you can actually promulgate abuse and mental health across generations. Northern Ireland's lasted 400 years. So I think mental health is something which we still don't know completely how to deal with. I think clearly there's post-traumatic stress disorder just there, and we think we need to create mechanisms where people can help themselves, because just going to a psychologist or a counsellor isn't enough.
I think someone in the audience wants to add a comment.
Yeah, I'm actually from Northern Ireland, so I'd just like to touch on that quickly. For sure, exactly resonated. That's a blessing to hear, and the fact that you're able to understand the generational turmoil that comes with such wars that are inflicted upon the people from government agendas and whatever else, you know, it all comes back to the solution and how we become better people. And I just wanted to, you know, put the voucher out there that, yes, I am from Northern Ireland, and I understand exactly what the Ukrainians are going through. And I feel like I can definitely vouch for a person that has been able to combat the struggles of the generational turmoil. And that's it. It's what comes with these trial and tested times that we have had to live. And I would like to, you know, stay here for a while to connect with anyone who feels like they need to understand how they can become more heart-centered and get to a place of abundance and gratitude for the smaller things in life that can be grown exponentially if you have the right community. And I'm so blessed to be here in Davos with all you people here and the team that I'm currently with, Goldfinger. I just have to be so thankful, because that community has been the source of lifting me to an elevated state where I am able to become a better person and help a lot of people around me become better people. And together as a collective, you know, the whole blockchain space and the land space, every team within here, you know, we can align and become a force to be reckoned with and start to show these governments and the people who have hidden agendas that we're here to make humanity the better race that it needs to be. Now that the times are starting to get tough, we need to align and share ideas and see, you know, what solutions we can come up with. So thank you, Doctor. I appreciate that. I can't wait to get a conversation with you after about your opinions on are we Northern Ireland. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we're obviously in a really powerful place, and I think, you know, it's really important that we empower as many people with that energy to be here and to shift, you know, especially the newer generations that are coming through. So I want to say a huge thank you to our three panelists for joining us today. It's been a really interesting and honest conversation, and I hope it sounds like it's really inspired all of you, so really happy about that. We will be having some cocktails, canapes. Tonight is our Shaping the Future, Land Summit dinner. And just want to sort of highlight that tomorrow is the day about disruptive decentralization. Obviously, a lot of disruptors coming to this space. Wednesday is Top Tier Impact Takeover. And then we're continuing on with sustainability and solidarity. In the room, we have Dr. Sian Proctor, an astronaut, joining us about how space could impact the UN SDG goals. We have perspectives from motorsports industry and race car drivers, as well as Alessa and some of her Top Tier Impact members. And then finally on Thursday, we've got Deepak Chopra joining us in the space to hopefully close the land space and the land summit with some incredible energy. And it will be about the future of leadership. So talking as well about the education system, we have the CEO of Montessori coming in, a really interesting philosophy around what Alessa was saying around what we're born with and how do we unlock that. And not get trapped by the education system and the societies around us. So thank you for joining us today. hope to see you guys later on this evening and encourage as much connection as possible.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed having these conversations. If you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com/Davos, where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. If you're interested in talking to me about future opportunities at Davos, producing podcasts, or coming down to some of my music and motorsports events, then you can reach out to me at missionmakers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Thank you as ever for listening. Until next time, keep it laser focused.